The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Got Jim back in the studio. He's gathered up a round of questions. Got a, I was about to say a beautiful day outside, but it's a little bit cloudy. But we got some nice rain yesterday, so Jim is tickled. He's changing his mind about moving to a more humid and muggy area because we actually get rain now in Colorado.
We had a day, folks, a day when it rained. And all these Colorado natives, they're beside themselves. I think they're jumping off bridges
it
right now.
It rained almost all day.
A day. How many in a year? We got 365, right? This is our first real day of rain. It was enjoyable. I liked yesterday. It reminded me of what I'm going to move to. An area where things are green.
You have to huddle inside to stay dry.
For those who don't know, Colorado is a high plains desert, and we get 11 inches of rain a year.
Denver's got 7.5 so far.
So it's been like wet for double, Denver standards. Mm-hmm. Of course, Chris is totally glossing over the fact that we had the largest wildfires in Colorado history last year because it never rained one damn day last year. And now he's complaining because we had a few days of rain.
It used to be snow. Rain only showed up here recently.
You realize Colorado's brown, right?
It is. Well, it's abnormally green because of all the humans that have planted green things.
And water them with water that is held in precious reservoirs. Yes.
So if you drive a little bit east of here, you can see what it's supposed to look like.
Which is brown.
Correct. Yeah. And well, it's supposed to be brown and covered with bison. So it's very different now than it used to be.
Now it's just brown, covered with cows.
And green as long as you can water, and then it turns brown when you can't. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what's amazing is when you're flying out of DIA and the plane is getting up, and you know DIA is surrounded with farmland, you can clearly see where those big round sprinkler things are. Yeah. Because you have these circles, folks, of green surrounded by brown dust and dead grass, and that is typical Colorado. But where there's water dropping on the agriculture, you'll see these little bouts of green. Okay, enough of that before we bore the heck out of people. But this is a Q&A show. Anything you want to get to before we get to the Q's and the A's?
No, I think we're good.
Okay, excellent. Before we get to this first Social Security question, we might do two Social Security questions today. I haven't decided, but we're definitely going to lead with one like we always do, a Social Security question from a New Yorker. We've got to clear the air on a few things. Apparently, you made an error on a recent show, so I want to...
What?
Well, let me bring it to everyone's attention because someone emailed us the error that you made. Where is it? Okay. So last week we did a show, if you remember, well, we did a show every week, but we had a question last week on the gentleman who was trying to move his 457, but the custodian wanted to withhold 20%. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And we were trying to tell the person that you don't have to if you do a direct trustee-to-trustee transfer. Mm-hmm. Well, on that show, this listener wanted to point out that I had mentioned he would just have to, if he wanted to do it as a rollover, if he still wasn't getting any help from his custodian, they were still going to withhold 20%. I said, just tell him to send you the money all in one as a distribution.
That won't work. They're going to withhold the 20%.
They're going to withhold the 20%. But I mentioned on there as I was trying to say that, and we did correct that part. We says, oh, but wait a minute, they're going to automatically withhold the 20%. But I also said, and you would have to make sure you didn't do one previously because you only do one every 365 days. This listener wrote and pointed out correctly that if the listener did try to do it that way as a direct rollover, in other words, he took the money and then put it back in, because it was coming from an employer plan and going into an IRA, it doesn't count.
That's true.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you
didn't
missed,
pick up on that.
Right. You didn't.
I missed correcting you.
Well, I was testing you. You see, that's what I was doing. And I was wondering if a listener would pick up on it or if you would pick up on it. Mm. And you didn't pick up on it. So this listener wrote, he wrote it as if he thought I made the error. I mean, naive, of course. But clearly, he didn't know that I was testing you. So I just wanted to clear the air there that Chris did misspeak by not correcting me.
I misspoke silently.
But all jokes aside, folks, yes, yours truly did not point out that if someone, not that anyone would ever try to do, if you're trying to avoid a 20% withholding tax, you're not going to ask for a direct rollover. You're not going to say give an indirect rollover. You're not going to say give me the money and I'm going to move it, because then they definitely have to withhold 20%.
Right.
But you're also not going to do that. Or excuse me, if you ever did do that,
you're not limited.
You're not limited. And that's one of the things that a lot of people don't realize. The one per year rollover rule, where you take the money out of your IRA and you hold it and you touch it and you play with it for 59 days. And on the 60th day, you get it back into an IRA or into a 401k. That's called a indirect rollover, if you will. You're limited to one a year unless it's going into or out of an employer plan, at which point you can do as many as you want. It's not limited at all to one per year. But anyways, this listener obviously picked up on it.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm glad they did, so they could correct my silence.
Yes. So I'm not going to hold it against you. You know, you make mistakes.
Thank you.
And I was testing you, and you failed the test.
I'll be on the lookout.
Okay, and then we have dueling banjos, if you will.
I don't have that sound.
Oh, that would have been a good sound effect.
Though.
That would have been
should've
a good sound.
Should have given me a heads
effect.
Up. I could easily get that.
Oh, that would have been a good one because we have two dueling banjos, if you will, folks, with people writing to me to relay to you, and you got these emails as well. On May 1st, we received an email from someone that says, and you got this email, Chris, this is a plea for a second weekly Q&A show. My health will depend on it. I listen to your podcasts on my daily walks, and I walk at least 4 miles a day, and one podcast is the perfect length for my walks. I've dropped 65 pounds in the last 18 months by walking, eating better, drinking, I like how he put, drinking crappier beer, more Miller Lights, less delicious IPAs. I agree on that if you're drinking Miller Lights. And what he wants, Chris, is additional podcasts so he can keep walking. His ability, he says, to keep this weight off lies solely in Chris's decision to do a second Q&A show. So there is someone for health reasons imploring you.
That's somewhat compelling.
And then the very next day, we got yet another email wanting to, quote unquote, weigh in on Jim's strong arm tactics to convince Chris to do a second show. And he says, frankly, as much as I enjoy your show with your banter and insights, I prefer to keep Chris focused on his planning aspect, as so many people like me would hate to be pushed further and further out to hire you for a planning date. He's waiting to get in your queue, I guess, is what he's saying. I'm sure you all remember the pause period Chris had to do last year, and I'm glad that's all behind you. But with more time spent on doing more podcasts in a 40-hour week, Chris will find himself pushing back consultations with current or future clients and maybe having to pause again. So that's my vote. I guess he wants you to keep working and not doing podcasts.
Oh, if I only had a 40-hour week, that would be so nice.
Well, I thought this whole six kids and a wife thing, that's taking
I'm
a lot of your
counting
time.
That.
But yeah. Do you ever figure out how much time in a week that
I've
takes?
Found a way, I've found a balance. I just have to completely ignore them.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying, if you didn't have the six kids and a wife, you'd have much more time to do work for these clients.
True.
And another podcast for the gentleman trying to lose weight. Anyways, folks, we did get two emails, dueling banjos, if you will. If anybody else wants to weigh in, I don't think we're winning any hearts and minds of Chris.
Well, I think those are both valid
over.
Arguments, so they offset one another, so we're back to neutral.
We're back to zero. We're back to zero. We don't know what we're going to do. But two very compelling arguments. One, for health reasons, you should do another show. And the second, for sanity reasons, you shouldn't do another show. So anyways, I just thought I would share those. And now, as always, let's lead in with a Social Security question so Chris can answer that. And then we're going to get to a couple of IRA questions and a few other things.
Perfect.
Sound like a plan?
Yes.
All right. This comes from upstate New York. We're going to call him George. He does leave his real name, but as always, we're going to call him George. He says, greetings from upstate New York, where we enjoy beautiful scenery and very high taxes. I think he was being a little facetious on the last part.
Maybe a little.
I don't know if people actually enjoy paying high taxes. Your podcast has been most helpful in increasing my retirement knowledge since...
A lot.
That's an evil, vile word as well.
Exponentially?
Exponentially. What did you say again?
I'm assuming it's exponentially, but you're the only one with the email in front of you.
Exponentially.
Yeah, exponentially.
Slow it down.
Exponentially.
Okay, exponentially.
There you go.
Excellent. Since I began listening to it about a year ago, thank you so much. My Social Security question is in regards to survivor benefits. I'm 63 and my wife is 62. Because of raising our children for much of her life, my wife is just shy of earning enough credits to be able to receive her own Social Security benefits. I'm projected to receive $3,100 at my full retirement age of 66 and 8 months. But I'm planning on waiting till 68 to collect my benefits. If I die prior to reaching my full retirement age, would my wife's survivor benefit be based on my projected full retirement age amount?
Okay, there's a couple ways this is figured, depending on when you pass away and how old your surviving spouse is when they go to claim your survivor benefit. If you were to pass away prior to reaching your full retirement age, your surviving spouse, their benefit is going to be based upon your full retirement age benefit. Even though you didn't get to there before you passed away, they won't be penalized that you passed away, quote, early. Now, the ability for them to collect that full benefit will be dependent upon them waiting until they themselves turn their full retirement age, which for survivor benefits, remember, can be a little bit different than for your own retirement benefits, but their full retirement age for survivor benefits, at that point, they would be able to claim your survivor benefit, your PIA, if you will, your full retirement age benefit, even if you'd passed away before that. If they claim before they reach full retirement age, then it will be reduced. If you live past your full retirement age and were delaying, they will give your surviving spouse the benefit of delayed retirement credits up until the point where you passed away, even though you weren't claiming yet. This is where a lot of people get confused that They will delay and they'll pass away, and then their survivor won't get any benefit for the delayed retirement credits. That's not how it works. They, in calculating delayed retirement credits for purposes of the survivor benefit left behind, they will calculate it based upon the idea of you having claimed the day before you passed away. So that would pass to them. The only other thing I'll say is if you claim before your full retirement age, you asked about dying before your full retirement age, what happens if you claim, thus reducing your own benefit before the full retirement age, that does reduce the survivor benefit for your surviving spouse, subject to certain protection limits. I'm not going to go into those specific limits right now because it gets a little convoluted and I don't have the formula off the top of my head. But if you claim, you can actually undermine the survivor benefit that otherwise would have been paid to your survivor through the act of early claiming yourself. You didn't ask about that, but I thought I would mention that. So there's kind of three scenarios. You claim early, thus penalizing your spouse. You die before you get to your full retirement age, no penalty. The spouse will get benefit of your full retirement age benefit, even though you died before that. Or delaying past your full retirement age will create delayed retirement credits up till the point you either claimed or passed away. That'd be the best way for me to summarize how that all works.
Okay, perfect. I like that. To answer this next question, if you could, you got the computer in front of you, and I never remember these dollar amounts. So as I'm reading the question, can you just have the earnings limits for Roth contributions in 2020?
2020 or 2021?
2020 opened.
Yeah.
Might as well have 2021s as well, but 2020s for sure based on his question. Okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So we got this listener's question, folks, from Dayton, Ohio. So he jumped to the top of the list. He says, hello, Jim, from Dayton, Ohio, the perfect area for you. I'm 45 minutes northwest of Cincinnati, and I keep thinking it's the perfect area for you, and you should look at the communities of Waynesville or Lebanon, Ohio, just northeast of Cincinnati. So anyways, another listener trying to help me in my never-ending search for a potential place to retire to between northern Kentucky and southern Ohio. Of course, I am planning a trip out there in July or August, Chris. And Chris insists that once I do that, I will never go back and you will never hear me talk again.
No, you'll go to visit. I'm not.
But you don't think I'm going to move there once I experience a summer?
You've been in Colorado way too long. Your skin has adapted to the dryness now. It's not going to know what to do when you're all sweaty and sticky.
I don't know. Okay. Anyways, he says, I've listened to your podcast for the past 3 years and never missed one. I'm very much on the learning curve and hear you guys touch on things that I never heard about, but keep listening and learning. So then he goes on to say, I'm 54 and my wife is 55. I have 30 years, and he asks me not to mention the company, even though he did name it, so we're going to call it Company X. I have 30 years at Company X and plan on retiring in late 2021 or in sometime in 2022. So over the next year and a half, Chris. Mm-hmm. I have an existing 401k with $520,000. When I retire, I will receive a lump sum pension payout of $630,000. My wife has a Roth IRA at Vanguard with $142,000 and a traditional IRA at Vanguard with $132,000. Okay. So he doesn't have an IRA yet, Chris. He doesn't have an IRA and he doesn't have a Roth.
Got it.
His wife does. She has an IRA and a Roth. The dollar amounts are immaterial, actually, based on his question. We file married jointly, and our Maggie for 2020 was $202,000. First of all, he wants to establish an IRA, a Roth IRA, by May 17th, the tax filing deadline. Why? He doesn't have one, folks. And if he opens one by May 17th and calls it a 2020 contribution, he will effectively, in the eyes of the IRS, have opened that IRA January 1st of 2020, mm-hmm. giving him one full year already of his five-year period, yep. mm-hmm. to get earnings out tax-free.
Got it.
Now, he freely admits he feels he's going to wait until after age 60 to withdraw any money from this IRA. He's only 54 today, but he's trying to get that extra year in just in case when he turns around age 60, he'll have satisfied the five-year hold. But I think his intent is to keep the money in the Roth longer, but he's trying to get that extra year. Mm-hmm. So his question is, first, would I have to open this Roth IRA as a back door? So if his Maggie is $202,000 in 2020, I don't have what the numbers are. Does that put him over the contribution limits?
No, he's in the phase-out period. The phase-out in 2020 was between 196 and 206. So at 202, his max contribution being over the age of 50 is $2,800.
Okay. He wrote he was planning on opening the IRA with $3,000.
So a little too much.
A little too much, listener. There is a phase-out, as Chris just mm-hmm. described, and based on $202,000 Maggie for 2020, you'll be able to put $2,800 in, but you do not have to do it as a back door. Why don't you explain to listeners what he was thinking he was going to have to do in case they don't understand this back door thing?
So what he was thinking he was going to have to do is make a non-deductible contribution to a traditional IRA first, which anyone can do at any earnings level. This is where you get around the phase out. So if he had... his Maggie was $220,000. He would have the ability to contribute zero to a Roth IRA. So the back door becomes viable. You make a non-deductible contribution to an IRA and then turn around and roll it over or convert it to a Roth IRA. That step is tax-free because you'll already have paid the tax on the money that went into the traditional IRA since you did not deduct it. That's why I called it a non-deductible contribution to the IRA in the first place. So can be done, a little convoluted. In this case, no, since he's not trying to maximize the contribution up to the 7,000 limit, which is what an individual 50 and older is allowed to put in just from an overall limit into IRAs. Since he's not trying to do that, he's just trying to get the clock started. He could put in $100 if he wanted to get the clock started. He just has to get that five-year clock started to reach his goal. And in his case, he hasn't hit the complete phase out, which happened in 2020 at $206,000 of modified adjusted gross income for a married filing joint couple. At 202, he's still allowed to put in up to $2,800 directly into a Roth. To be safe, you know, if he really has 202 and some change, he might want to round it down a little bit, maybe make it 2100 or 2000 instead, just to be sure. But he can do the math. This is easily calculated. There's a lot of online resources to calculate this phase out, but I've got the limitations for every $1,000 from 196 to 206. Technically it phases out in between there, but those are the limits. So, you know, he can put a couple $1,000 in there, no problem. And given what he has shared with us, I haven't heard anything yet that would prevent him from doing this.
Okay, then he continues with a second question. He says, and where is it? Secondly, if I do this, will I be putting this Roth into a situation of having it be subject to the pro rata rule? And I think he's getting a little confused here on some of these pro rata rule. I think what he was saying is his first question was, do I have to do this as a back door? The answer is no, obviously. The second question is, if I do have to do it as a back door, like you just described, will I be subject to the pro rata rule in the Roth? You won't, if you did do it that way, let's say your earnings, folks, weren't a listener, wasn't $202,000, it was $222,000 of Maggie. So you wouldn't be able to contribute to a Roth. You could have at that point put all $7,000 into, and he still could, Chris. He can put $2,800 in a Roth. He can put the difference, what does that come to? What's the limit?
$4,200.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So he could put $4,200 in a non-deductible IRA and immediately convert it into that same Roth. So he can do that. So what he needs to understand is he will not be subject to the pro rata rule because he doesn't have an existing IRA.
Right.
But his wife, Chris, what would happen to her? Remember, she has a, I believe it was $132,000 in a traditional IRA. What? Mm-hmm. Why is her inability to do that being impacted by the pro rata rule and so, not his?
Yeah, so there, if she puts it into the IRA through a non-deductible contribution, she's going to have a mix. The 132 she has in there now that's pre-tax money, deductible contributions and growth that has happened, and then she puts in a non-deductible IRA contribution in order to take the first step in a backdoor Roth technique. And now when it comes out, when it flows out during that second step conversion phase or rollover phase from the IRA to the Roth IRA, those monies are going to come out pro rata between the pre- and post-tax dollars in there, and they're going to be mostly pre-tax dollars that get rolled out because there's $132,000 in there. Put another $7,000 in, and you've got $7,000 out of $139,000. That's the proportion that's going to come out tax-free because you've already paid tax on it, but you're going to be triggering a tax event through the conversion of the rest of that proportional conversion slash rollover. So that's where the pro rata rule comes in. It's only if you have an existing IRA. At the end of the year that you do the conversion slash rollover to the Roth, so keep that in mind. There's always that gotcha that's in there. But in his case, since he has no IRA monies now, there's no pro rata issue. And the good news is we don't even have to really address that with him because he has not been phased out completely from just making a direct Roth contribution.
Right. And listen, to the pro rata doesn't impact your Roth. Your Roth always will. It's not going to be subject to pro rata. The pro rata is in the IRA situation and how the conversion, when you go from a non-deductible IRA into the Roth, if you had a prorate, some of the conversion would be subject to taxes. It's not going to cause you to have to track any type of basis inside your Roth, though. And I think that's what he might have also been thinking. He's not going to have any type of issues inside his Roth. It's the taxation of the conversion because of the pro rata rule. Does that kind of make sense, or did I confuse people more than you think?
No, I think we...
Okay. So we have a similar question to that with an IRA that has to do with pro rata rules. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I can chat about this one too. It makes sense. So this begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. In the 1990s, I put after-tax money into a traditional IRA. Let's call that IRA 1, Chris. Mm-hmm. And filed Form 8606, which I included in my tax returns every year I did this." Mm-hmm. So he started in the 90s, so a long time ago. "I also had a 401k with my employer, and upon retirement, I did a rollover IRA." Mm-hmm. So we'll call that IRA 2. So he did not combine them. He purposefully kept them separate. Traditional IRA, Chris, that he put after-tax basis in, but over the years since the 1990s, obviously it's been growing. Mm-hmm. So he has a mix of basis and never taxed money. Mm-hmm. And then he has a rollover, which is all pre-tax money, but he kept them separate. He didn't mix them. That's key. "I am now 66 and I'm not taking my RMDs, but I have withdrawn funds from IRA number 2 and not from IRA number 1. And I did that 2 times. So see what he's trying to do, Chris? He's thinking, if I limit it to just the IRA that contained his 401k that he moved, he might be okay. And you know where I'm going with this.
I do.
Mm-hmm. So his question is this. I have been told by two different CPAs two different answers regarding how the withdrawal should be prorated. And he did reference again, he has Form 8606. For those who don't know, listeners, 8606 is the form you list after-tax basis you made to an IRA. When you put money in an IRA and you do not deduct it, like in the previous example, I told that listener he could put in, what was it,
4,200
more?
Mm-hmm.
If you did do that, listener, if you do put $4,200 more into a non-deductible IRA and convert it, this is the previous question, and convert it, you still have to file Form 8606 to tell the IRS that $4,200 I put in this IRA, I did not deduct. It is after-tax money. It is what we call IRA basis. Okay, so this gentleman made two withdrawals, Chris, restricting his withdrawals specifically to IRA number two, mm-hmm. the rollover IRA that only contains his 401k. But he tells me in the letter, or tells us in his email, that he got two different answers from two mm-hmm. different CPAs.
There's only one right answer.
There's only one. Okay.
I'll tell you that right now.
So the first CPA said, the pro rata applies only if he withdraws from IRA number one. You were ready for that one.
I was ready.
The second CPA said, you might want to get the claps ready for this gentleman, or gentlewoman, we don't know if it's a man or woman. Second CPA said the balance for both IRA number one and IRA number two needs to be combined for the pro rata. That CPA also told me if I had left the 401k and never did a rollover, then I could have applied the proration formula to just my traditional IRA alone. Can you clarify which CPA is correct? And provide specific IRS sources where I can review it.
Well, the first part of that answer, actually, I just realized we found a question that we were able to answer without uttering a word. We did utter words, but we could have answered it simply with the sound effects. That's amazing.
True. You could have done it with just sound right. effects.
I guess I'm the only one who's impressed by that. But anyway, far as sources go.
If you could, though, one thing. Explain to our listeners the pro rata issue here is with the taxation of the withdrawals.
Yeah, the one rule to always remember, all your IRAs are one big IRA in the eyes of the IRS. It does not matter that you have broken them up, kept them separate in different accounts with different account numbers, one at Vanguard, one at Fidelity, one at Schwab, one at your local bank. It doesn't matter. In the eyes of the IRS, you have one IRA. That is it. There's subtle times when having sequestered money in a single IRA can be helpful, such as money rolled over from an ERISA plan, keeping it cleanly in its own standalone IRA account could help you out in the future if you ever had to prove that that money, which money of your total IRAs was directly connected to that ERISA plan originally. But that's really the only time I can think of that having them separate is of any real benefit. In cases like this for taxation, IRS doesn't care how many IRAs you have. It's one to them. So any calculations, including this one, where there's proration involved, would require consideration of all the pre-tax in all the accounts and all of the after-tax in all the accounts has to be considered. Just think of it as one big pool. Just treat it as one big IRA, and you'll do the calculations correctly.
Exactly. And his second part of the question, can we give him the part of the IRC code that addresses that? You'll actually find it. Listen, I don't know the part of the code. I just know that these are the rules. You most likely, though, will find it not in the IRC code. You're going to find it in Publication 590.
Yeah, the Bible of IRAs.
The Bible of IRAs. Mm. Download Publication 590. There's two pots, A and B. I'm not sure what pot it will be. It'll be a PDF. Start doing some search in the PDF for the word pro rata or other types of words, or look at the table of contents, but you will find it in there where the IRS is going to tell you that they are going to look at all your IRAs as one. So the first CPA was totally wrong. The second CPA was totally right. And the listener then ends with, I guess he's just disgusted now with hiring people to do his taxes. He says, for 20 years, I did my own taxes, but then I got married and itemized deductions and everything else got complicated. I turned it over to a tax person. But now he's upset with these two CPAs because they're disagreeing with each other. You should be upset at the first CPA. This is a basic rule. So, again, I don't know if that person really is a CPA or if they were just a tax preparer, but it's a basic, simple rule they should have known. I will say that. But he asks if he should go back to TurboTax, and do we know anyone who can help him learn TurboTax? No, I don't know anyone.
I don't know that I would throw all tax preparers out just because one gave a bad answer.
No, I'm not saying to stop.
No, I'm not talking about it. That's what he's saying.
Oh, yeah,
he's
he wants to go back to TurboTax.
Yeah, exactly.
But just because one got it wrong, the other one got it right.
Right, both parts of it. Both statements they made were correct.
So the second CPA definitely has their act together. You may want to continue using them. But I don't know anyone who can teach you TurboTax or help walk you through TurboTax. That's going to have to be something you do as a do-it-yourselfer and learn. But the first CPA was wrong, second one was correct, and I would continue working with the second one and not necessarily the first one. But as for the actual IRC code, you're probably going to find it more in Publication 590, either in Part A or B. Download that, read through it, or try to do some keyword searches in the search function in your Adobe Reader, and you might be able to find that section where the IRS clearly
indicates. See if I can pull it up while you're talking on the next question, and I'll tell people where it is exactly.
If it is in there, yeah, if you can find it that way. But they do consider all IRAs as one. But there are some exceptions, as Chris said, but
here's the IRC section. It's called the, well, we haven't mentioned the word, but it's called aggregation. That's what we're talking about. All IRAs are considered one IRA. They're all aggregated together, described in IRC section 408, D as in dog, 2.
And did you get that from 590 or from Google?
I got this from Kitsis. Happened to come up in the Google search, and he happens to quote the IRC section that talks about aggregation and the pro rata distribution.
But there's probably 590 folks is examples. The IRS walks you through actual hypothetical examples, but they'll walk you through all these examples. I guarantee you in 590 they have something on.
Yeah, they do. I just stumbled across this first. Yeah. So.
Okay, so there's your section. We did get it for you off the internet, but I would also look in 590, and I can guarantee you they have examples in 590 walking you through this and how you have to treat those as one. Okay, sound like a plan?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, next one here. Long question. I think it'll be a short answer. So it says, Jim and Chris, on one of your more recent podcasts, you were talking about, okay, I see where he's going this. I thought it was an LTC question, but he leads in with a annuity question. Back to that money. Remember that Money Magazine where we said Money Magazine wasn't laying out the full story?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm going to skip that because he was actually asking a question on LTC. So his first paragraph is pointing that out. We don't need to get into that. I want to get into the meat and potatoes of his question. So I'm going to skip that first part and go to his second paragraph. So now my question is concerning a hybrid LTC policy. Say you put $100,000 now in a policy, a hybrid policy, and it grows over time for your LTC benefits. But if you don't use it, your heirs will not get back the benefit growth that you can use for LTC. They will only get back the $100,000 that you put in. So before I go on, this gentleman is correct. And for those of you who don't know how these hybrids, he's talking about a hybrid built on a life insurance chassis. And we talked about them on previous shows. But you do what he described. You put a lump sum of money in, and $100,000 is not a crazy amount. That's, you might put somewhere within 20-30% of that. But he's using $100,000. So you put $100,000 in, and it buys a certain amount of LTC coverage, Chris. That LTC coverage will often have a COLA adjustment. Right. And the LTC coverage increases, but your $100,000 is what you initially put in. And these policies, folks, are designed to pay back the money that you put in. Now, it gets a little tricky. If you die early in the policy, you might not get as much back, or you might get more back, actually. Yeah. But you hit a certain point where the listener is correct. The death benefit of that life insurance policy pretty much mirrors the amount of money you put in. So he's saying you're going to get all this embedded growth in the policy.
And well, the policy benefits.
The policy benefit, mm-hmm. not inside the policy. You're correct. The policy benefit, but the amount you get back is just what you put in, or $100,000.
Think of that as the cost of having this protection in place over that time period. That's kind of the way I describe it to people who are kind of weighing the pros and cons of this, because he's absolutely right. Doing the math, keeping that $100,000 out, assuming it grew over that period of time, heirs would get a larger amount than just the $100,000 coming back from a return of premium style hybrid.
You're reading this man's mind, because that's mm-hmm. what he continues. He says, but say you have your money in this policy for 30 years. Couldn't you have actually invested it instead over that 30-year period mm-hmm. to build up maybe what the policy would have provided if you never even bought it and you don't need it? Your heirs now would get that full amount. Mm-hmm. So he's saying, rather than put $100,000 in the LTC policy, what if you invested it? Couldn't it have grown to a level, he's saying, more than what the LTC's embedded benefit might have been? Mm-hmm. And then if you died and never spent it, your heirs would have got that instead of just $100,000 mm-hmm. back and no growth over that 30-year period. Mm-hmm. Couple of things, listener. It's hard to say if your $100,000 would have grown to more or less. It all depends on the initial pool that the $100,000 purchased when you bought the LTC policy. Because do keep in mind, if you put $100,000 day one into an investment and $100,000 day one into that LTC policy, and the very next day, day two, you were in a car accident and now you're in a wheelchair. Just because he's only 51 years old, he says. Mm-hmm. So you needing LTC the very next day isn't going to happen unless you probably suffered an accident. So you had an auto accident. You're now in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. You qualify for LTC.
Right.
In your self-funding pool, listener, you got $100,000. In the LTC policy, you probably have $200,000, $230,000,
$240,000. I think more than that.
Or more. I don't know what it is. I'm just making mm-hmm. these numbers up. You're going to have instant leverage in the LTC policy. And it's that leveraged amount, whether it was $200,000, $230,000, $250,000, whatever it bought initially, it's that higher amount that's growing at the COLA adjustment, usually 3 to 5%, simple or compound, you generally choose. So it's a much bigger amount, Chris, even though it might be growing a smaller amount, it started at a much higher amount. It's hard to say which one's going to have the most, but he highlights the conundrum of insurance. If you don't need it, you would have been better off not buying it. Well, no kidding. Absolutely.
Yeah, and in this particular case, focusing on the end value, you're right, there could be this very big difference. But what you are failing to recognize is you don't have control over when you are going to need the long-term care benefit if you do. It could happen early, middle, or late. or, of course, not at all, which is what he's focusing on. And if it doesn't work at all, then yes, would it have been better for your heirs to not buy this insurance? Absolutely. But if you want the protections of it, particularly during, you know, the time where you might end up with if you get a long-term care event in your late 80s, you're probably not going to last very long. If you have a long-term care event at 60 or 62, it might be the kind that is due to an accident or something like that, and you need a lot of care for an extended period of time. And that leveraging that you get from these policies, and the last, you know, the leverage I'm seeing in these lately, I've seen a few of them come by with people that have either had their own, they brought them to me and showed them to me, or Greg talked to them about a plan they were putting together. The leveraging is noticeably higher than what you're even mentioning, Jim. You're mentioning only, you know, two and a half times. I'm seeing 3 to 4.5 times.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the leverage is, but
That $100,000 immediately becomes $300,000-$400,000 of benefits, and then those benefits grow over time as long as you've picked one that has that feature on it.
Right. And all insurance is different, but this type of insurance, you're buying leverage right up front, this big pool of money right up front. But you can say the same thing, listener. Would you have been better off never having health insurance if you didn't need it, never buying homeowners insurance if you never filed a claim? Absolutely. You buy insurance to cover you in case you need it. All you do-it-yourselfers, you look at everything through the eyes of a return. What would have given me the, as if dying with the most money is the way you win. And maybe for some of you it is, although you really don't get bragging rights in heaven or hell if you died with the most money. To me, I'd rather enjoy the money and spend it and feel like I've taken care of myself. And the leverage from LTC can often help in that case. But it's not a matter of did I win, did I lose? I mean, I quote unquote won, Chris, on health insurance for the last 2 years. Cost $250,000 to the insurance company after my stroke and $158,000 after my heart surgery this year. I'm not jumping up and down saying, I won. I'd rather have my health and never have filed a damn claim. But I was grateful that I had it. I don't look at what the potential return might be, but I know a lot of people do. So everything you said, listener, is true. I'm not going to say you were right. I'm not going to say you're wrong. He does write to us, Chris, and says, I'm struggling with LTC as I'm only 51. I'm worried about the premiums growing over time. So that's why he doesn't want to buy a regular policy. He likes the lump sum policies. But he says, my challenge is trying to figure out the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And
just make sure you don't need it until you amass enough money to pay for it. That's exactly. that's the issue here. Yes, if it grew to an amount, if you were lucky enough to have it grow aggressively, rapidly over time. Now, you know, that money invested could go down too. Always got to keep that in mind. But assuming it goes up fast enough so that it's built up enough money for you to need when you need it. So you simply tell me when you're going to need it, and I can do the math to help you decide if that's going to work or not. Well, of course, we can't answer that first part. We don't know when it's going to be needed. That's the big challenge. And in the upside down world of retirement planning, believe it or not, having this kind of protection for those of you who choose to do something about long-term care, there's always those who ignore it and they freely spend the rest of their money because they're ignoring this potential. Those who want to do something about it, having a policy actually frees up more money for spending in your go-go period than not having it. Because if you don't have this leveraging, you've got to, remember, I'm talking to people who are wanting to address this. If you're addressing it through self-funding, you've got to set aside a big chunk if you want to, actually do something legitimate about protecting yourself, which limits how much can be spent early on. As time goes by, things might change. You could free up some of that, but you're going to be older, may not be in your go-go period anymore. Carving off less and getting the leverage benefits from the insurance company, yes, you give it up a little bit more fully rather than leaving it all to the side and hopefully never to touch it, but it actually reduces how much you need to carve off to address this issue, leaving more money in the fund pool. It's totally backwards from the way people think about it. They're thinking, oh, I don't want to put that money into insurance because that won't be money I can spend on fun. Well, unless you're going to be the ostrich with its head in the sand, which I don't think they really do anyway, but you know what I mean, and not address it at all, having the insurance is less expensive as far as a carve-off. It's less of a commitment than committing to full self-funding, which is a significant number, which really hampers fund spending if you're actually going to hold that off like you're committed to doing.
Right, and he wants to retire at 56, mm-hmm. still young, ostensibly to spend money on mm-hmm. fun things.
Right.
Now, you may have sufficient enough assets, but if you don't, it becomes a seesaw ride between the younger you and the older you. The younger you wants to spend this money on fun, the older you wants to make sure it's there for them if they need it for aging assistance. And it becomes this dueling banjo again. We led with dueling banjo and we're closing with dueling. We really need to get the dueling banjo sound effect.
I'll dig that up.
But what I want to let this listener know is what you're saying is true. I'm not going to dispute that. If you never needed it, you would have been better off never buying it. I am not going to dispute that. But that's not what you should be considering when anyone purchases insurance. And again, I'm living proof of that. Having health insurance saved me big time. But when I was on the floor of the bond, I shared this with everyone a couple of months ago, having my stroke on the floor of my bond. For a brief moment, when I was too tired to keep trying to drag myself, Chris, I was thinking, how the hell am I going to pay for this? I mean, as bizarre as that is, folks, I wasn't thinking about dying. I told you that before. That was one of the last things I was thinking of.
They don't charge you then if you die.
That was the easy part. I honestly was thinking, how am I going to pay for this? Because I thought I was going to be paralyzed for the rest of my life. The doctors thought I was going to be. And the wrong time to think about it is when you're on the floor of your bond. But if I was him, remember, I was only 57 when I had my stroke. What if I had put Chris $100,000 off to the side and told you, hey, I'm investing this, Chris, for my long-term care as instead of putting $100,000 into a policy? I would have had less. Because I wouldn't have had the leverage. So a lot of it has to do is when do you need it? It's not just how much is it going to grow to, when are you going to need it? So we are going to do a show. We keep trying to get Greg on, but for a variety of reasons, we can't get Greg on. And then Chris and I's schedule is a little messed up. And Greg and I have been working on two shows to do on LTC strategies. And both of them tie into listener questions, his included. But one of the strategies is going to be kind of helping him. So keep listening, listener, and all listeners. A strategy, Chris, that might appeal to him, where he is doing a little bit of both, putting some money aside and doing some tricks with insurance. And we'll share that on a future show. This is about as deep as I want to get into it. I want to wrap up with this one last very easy question. Mm-hmm. And I think, do we have enough time?
Yeah.
Okay, this has got to be one of the most confusing worded. I'm not going to read this email because it's just going to confuse the hell out of people. I understand what he's saying, and I think at the end he realized he did not write a clear email because he said, sorry about the wording of this email, but I think Professor Chris will help rephrase this if needed.
I'll give it a crack.
So I'm not.
Although I have to base my interpretation on Jim's interpretation because he's about to read it to me cold because I haven't heard this before.
Right. And fortunately, there's no big words like that.
Exponential.
That word there mm-hmm. that someone hit me with earlier in the show. But I know what he's asking, Chris. He doesn't word it well. So I'm going to begin and then kind of explain what he's asking. Mm-hmm. So he says, and he's from Arizona, for those who want to know. He's an Arizonian. We're going to call him George. But I will say his name is a really cool name. Like, we have a couple of people with really cool names lately. It's too bad we protect people's anonymity because I could have been sharing some real cool names. Okay. Dear Jim and Chris, these questions involve my required minimum distributions. I turned 72 December 19th of 2022. Let's pretend I have $400,000 in my IRA. And I want to do a $35,000 conversion into my Roth IRA in 2022. So I am going to delay my first required minimum distribution until the last day I'm required to do so, April 1st of 2023. Then he gets
real... Can I play the buzzer sound yet?
Sure, you can. Okay. So Chris just burst your bubble, listener. Not only can't you do that, he then asked a whole series of questions on how to figure out what his RMD really is going to be if he delays the first one. What value does he look at? And he starts mentioning all these ages and dollar amounts. And what he was wondering too, Chris, was he was saying, how will the IRS treat that $35,000 conversion that he wants to do? Will it be RMD? Would it not be RMD? Can he put all $35,000 in to the account? He's just was asking a bunch of questions. So let me walk you through this, all listeners. Chris buzzed the buzzer for one simple reason. Beginning January 1st of the year you turn 72, used to be the year you turned 70 and a half, which got very confusing to people sometimes because they would turn 70 one year but not 70 and a half till the following right. year. But now it's easy. It's 72. He turned 72, Chris, December of 2022. Mm-hmm. Beginning January 1st of 2022, the first dollars out of his IRA are what, Chris?
They're RMDs. No way to alter that. And we know on that day what the RMD needs to be, no matter whether he takes it then or waits 15 months and takes it April 1st of the following year, which he is allowed to do on his first RMD. But we know it January 1st of 2022 in his case because it's the balance December 31st of the previous year, a day before in my example, that sets the RMD for that particular year. So he will not be able to do a conversion in 2022 until after he has satisfied the entire RMD for that year, and then additional conversions could be made, but I suspect that's not in his plan,
right.
and he doesn't want to do it that way.
So do remember a few things, all listeners, this one included, and Chris hit the nail on the head. The first dollars out of your IRA beginning January 1st. This guy doesn't turn 72, folks, till December 19th. Nearly a full 12, almost a full 12 months into the year. Mm-hmm. But beginning January 1st, the first dollars out of his IRA will be considered RMDs, and RMDs cannot be what, Chris?
Converted. So if he turns around and puts it in his Roth IRA, he's now made an excess contribution to his Roth IRA, and be prepared for more negative ramifications from that.
Exactly.
Luckily, we headed this off, so he hopefully won't try to do this. It's always unfortunate to hear from people when they tell us, oh, this is what I did, and then we have to explain how to undo it. Don't do this in the first place. There is no way to do that conversion with the first dollars out beginning in the year he turns 72. Even if his intention was to wait until the following year, the RMD is due as of January 1st. It's almost like they send you an invoice and say, here's your RMD. We're giving you until April 1st of next year to pay it. In the future years, we'll give you an invoice on January 1st every single year, and you have to pay it by the end of the year, by December 31st.
So he said, say my RMD is $19,000. He wants to know how this will work. Well, the first $19,000 out of your IRA cannot be put into the Roth as a conversion. So if you wanted to quote-unquote convert $35,000, that means you wanted to pay taxes on an additional $35,000 or at least declare an additional $35,000 as income. Whether you'd pay taxes on it or not remain to be seen depending on how your taxes play out. You would only be able to put $19,000 into your Roth. The first $16,000 out beginning January 1st of the year you turn 72.
I think you reversed those two. I think his RMD, he said, was 19.
No, he says, pretend my RMD is 16.
Oh, okay, then I've reversed it.
Yes, you reversed it. Yep, no problem. So using those numbers, January 1st of the year you turn 72, if you were going to try to convert, even if you waited to the following year, it's not going to take your RMD. If you convert in the year you turn 72, the first dollars out of RMD, in your example, $16,000, meaning you could do a $19,000 conversion, listener, not a $35,000. Then he wants to know the amounts to use if he delays. Well, you again made it very easy. Just because you delay, as Chris pointed out, listener, your 2022 RMD until 2023, on January 1st, you know what your RMD is going to be. You simply take the December 31st value, the value of the day before, you take the December 31st value of that IRA, and you divide it, and you're going to be doing this in the year 2022 when we have the new tables, so you're going to go to the new joint life table and find the divisor for a 72-year-old, divide that, that's the RMD. So if you wait, he's confused. If he waits to 2023, he wanted to know, does he use 2022's balance or 2021's balance or 2022's if he delays the first one until April of 2023? You use 2021. That's the balance you are going to use. And then your second RMD that you would take out in 2023, you would use December 31st of 2022. So if he walks through slowly, it all makes sense. But we get hit with these questions a lot on the show. People thinking, Chris, I'm going to be smart. I'm going to delay that first RMD so I can convert more. Mm-hmm. And you can't do it because beginning January 1st of the year you turn 72, the first dollars out of your IRA are always RMDs. Right.
And I do, since you brought up the tables, I want to clear up something too that I hear a lot of people get confused about which table to use. And we always talk about, we generally talk about two of them. There's three tables. There's the uniform lifetime table, there's the single life table, and the joint life table. Jim talked about using the joint life, which would be true if this person is married, has a spouse that are more than 10 years younger, and
no, I said he would use the unified table.
No, you said joint life table.
No.
Yep, you did.
We'll go back to the tape and listen, but I don't think I did. Continue on.
If he did, he was talking about someone who's married, has a spouse more than 10 years younger, and they are the IRA's sole beneficiary. Those are the people who use the joint life table. The uniform lifetime table, which is more commonly used, is for all unmarried IRA owners or married owners whose spouses aren't more than 10 years younger. And the married owners whose spouses aren't the sole beneficiaries of their IRAs. So there's always that extra group in there that we don't really talk about. Married owners whose spouses aren't the sole beneficiaries of their IRAs use the uniform lifetime table. So even if your spouse is more than 10 years younger, if they're not the sole beneficiary, you still use the uniform lifetime table.
Then the sole primary beneficiary, I will say.
Good point. Sole primary beneficiary. Yep. The single life table is used for beneficiaries who are not the spouse, but only, of course, if they qualify for using the table. Most, of course, are going to end up using the 10-year or 5-year rule, depending on what's going on now, but what their situation is. But those are the, you know, the uniform and the joint table. Jim, I swear, said joint table.
Did I?
So I just wanted to clarify that because there are people who use the joint table. Married folks whose spouse is 10 years younger, so when there's a big age difference, and that spouse is the sole primary beneficiary. That's the joint life table. Most everybody else uses the uniform lifetime table unless you're a beneficiary, then you might be able to use the single life table, but those are the classifications or groups that use those different tables for RMD calculations.
Okay.
Okay, just wanted to add a little flourish there.
Thank you. And I could have sworn I said uniform lifetime table, but if I said joint life table, it could be right. I don't know right. if
that's
he's married to someone more than 10 years younger.
Yeah, that's why I didn't. When you said it, I didn't immediately correct you because it could be right. We didn't know. We don't have the details about the spouse, or even if there is one.
I'm thinking of doing a few shows on RMDs again. So we'll walk everybody through.
Yeah,
we'll need to talk
about the new table since they're coming up in 2022. How that's going to change people who start RMDs. Then what happens if you've already been taking RMDs? So I think there's a little bit of confusion, or at least the unknown out there that we can help people understand in preparation for 2022.
Yeah, the biggest confusion is going to be on inherited IRAs. You got to do a few little tricks when they adopt the new tables, but it's fairly straightforward for everyone else. But we'll go over all that. Do we have more time, or are we wrapping up?
No, that's about it for today.
Okay, perfect. Well, thanks, folks. I'm going to let Chris wrap up the show, but it was a pleasure again. If you have any questions, Chris is going to explain to you how to get questions to us. And, of course, we try to lead with a Social Security question. So if you have any of those, we've got a few. So we're covered for the next few weeks, Chris, on Social Security questions. But if people want to send those in or any type of question, we'd be glad to try to get it on the show. And we're still batting 50-50, or as Chris said, we're back to neutral on whether or not we're going to do an additional show or not.
1-4, 1-against so far.
Yeah, 1-1. But we shall see who wins this battle of the minds. Something tells me it'll be Chris who wins, because I have no clue how to run the recording equipment. So even if he said, no, do it yourself, I wouldn't be able to.
That's true. I have some power here.
Yeah. You could tell me. You do it if you want to do it. I can't. I have no clue. You got buttons everywhere in there, and I would not know what you're doing. Okay. But anyways, I'll let Chris wrap up this show. It was a pleasure, folks, and I'll talk to you again next week.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, if you're interested in sending us a question, best way to do that is go to the website jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, there's a contact form. You can submit questions that way. You can also send questions directly to Jim's email, jim@jimhelps.com. And feel free to send your reasons why we should stick to only two shows, one EDU show and one Q&A show every week. Make sure you send those to Jim so he can see those. Copy me in case he tries to destroy them. I'd like to have the evidence as well. If you want another show, I guess, with a compelling reason, although we've heard a pretty compelling one with the health, we're saving his health by doing extra shows. That one's hard to argue against, so I will give them benefit that they came up with an argument I wasn't expecting. But we'll see, and we'll take your questions either way. We'll get through as many as we can, and no matter how many shows we do, jimhelps.com, best way to contact us. We appreciate everybody listening, and we'll be back next week with another single Q&A show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.